Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 22, Text 42. The chapter is Elements of Material Creation. Indriyana Shishtyedyam Trividyam Bhati Vastuni Bahyanta Vidahetu Janasaj Janakrityata Indriya Ayana. By the resting place of the senses, the mind. Srishtya. Because of the creation of identification with a new body. Idam. This. Trividyam. Threefold variety of high, middle, and low class. Bhati. Appears. Vastuni. In the reality. The soul. Bahi. External. Antaha. And internal. Vida. Of the differences. Hetu. The cause. Jana. A person. Asatjana. Of a bad person. Krit. The progenitor. Jata. As. Translation. Because the mind, which is the resting place of the senses, has created the identification with a new body, the threefold variety of high, middle, and low class appears as if present within the reality of the soul. Thus, the self creates external and internal duality, just as a man might give birth to a bad son. So please repeat. Because the mind, which is the resting place of the senses, has created the identification with a new body, the threefold material variety of high, middle, and low class appears as if present within the reality of the soul. Thus the self creates external and internal duality, just as a man might give birth to a bad son. Purport. The wealth, beauty, strength, intelligence, fame, and detachment of different bodies are considered to be excellent, normal, or inferior according to the material situation. The spirit soul acquires a particular body and thus judges himself and others to be high, middle, or low class according to their material situation. Actually, the eternal soul exists beyond material duality, but falsely mistakes the material situation to be his own. The words asajjana krityata are significant. A father may by nature be peaceful, but because his bad son gets into trouble, the father is forced to defend the son and consider his son's enemies to be enemies of the entire family. Thus, the bad son implicates the father in troublesome conflicts. Similarly, the spirit soul has no intrinsic problems, but by creating a false identification with the material body, the soul becomes involved in the happiness and distress of the body. With this verse, the Lord summarizes his discussion of the difference between the body and the soul. Om Magyanati Marandasyakaranjana Shurakaya Chakshuramilitam Jena Tasmaye Sri Guru Vindamaha Panchapaparu Vishakritasamadeva Chakritikanam Shnadevi Onamohanam. So in the previous verses, the Lord has been discussing with Uddhava different aspects which distinguish the body from the soul, primarily by describing some of the features of bodily existence and how and the separateness of the soul. So we might just briefly recap before we tackle the contents of this verse and purport. So we go back a little bit where Krishna begins speaking. So the mind is shaped by the reactions of fruitive work, and according to the five senses it travels from one body to another. The spirit soul, although different from this mind, follows it. So actually the soul, because it falsely identifies with the material condition and accepts that as his ultimate reality, he becomes a passenger in that condition. Isn't it? So this is here, as Krishna is saying, the spirit soul, although different from the mind, actually just follows, it just tags along. And it's like, so in conditioned life, we have limited choices. And we see this in the lower species where the choices are even more reduced. Or depending on our condition. You know, when we're just a passenger, we have very limited choices. Like if we're in a car, you know, we're simply going where the driver of the car is taking it. So the driver of the body is the intelligence, and the mind is the reins. So the reins are guiding the direction of the body, is setting the direction. The rein, we have this description in the Gita that the chariot of the body, the reins, the mind are the reins. So it's the mind that is giving the direction to which way the body is going. So the soul identifying with the body is simply along for the ride, so to speak. So this point is, so of course people are prone to think, well, you know, I have my independence and everything, but as soon as we make certain choices in life, the independence then becomes limited to the conditions of those choices. We choose to inhabit a particular body by the actions of our fruitive work, and then we're carried along like that. And particularly if we go into the lower species, then the choices are more and more and more limited. Is it? Prabhupada would often describe how in human life we have the opportunity to make choices about and inquiries about who we are and what our ultimate purpose is. Whereas the animal species, you know, they don't actually even accrue any new karma. They're just along for the ride, so to speak, in their particular bodily situation. Like that. Just continuing here to summarise. So the mind, the resting place of the senses, has created the identification with a new body. That's this verse. I just wanted to go back. The mind, bound to the reactions of fruitive work, always meditates on the objects of the senses. But those that are seen in this world and those that are heard about from Vedic authority, both those. So consequently, the mind appears to come into being and to suffer annihilation with its objects of perception, and thus it is able to distinguish past, and thus its ability to distinguish past and future is lost. And then, when the living entity passes from the present body to the next body, which is created by his own karma, he becomes absorbed in the pleasurable and painful sensations of the new body and completely forgets the experience of the previous body. This total forgetfulness of one's previous material identity, which comes about for one reason or another, is called death. So this is the key distinguishing difference between the body and the soul. The purport concluded here that, you know, Krishna, in this verse, today's verse, he summarizes his discussion on the difference between the body and the soul. So this is the key difference between a body and a soul. That bodies undergo this experience called death. Isn't it? And death here is defined as total forgetfulness of one's previous material identity. Interesting. Which comes about for one reason or another. We can't, you know, death comes of its own cause to the body. It's the nature of the body. Because then, the next verse, he tells Uddhava, what is called birth is simply a person's total identification with a new body. So birth and death, the two distinguishing factors of a material body, two things that the soul does not have to undergo. So one is total forgetfulness of one's material identity, previous material identity, and the other is total identification with a new body. It is referred to as being sarvabhavena. It is complete, it is total. When we become, you know, completely enamored with this concept of who I am, you know, in this body. So many upadis are there attached to our body, our condition, and we identify, you know, people ask us, well, who are you, or, you know, and we'll rattle off a whole list of upadis, a whole list of, you know, connections which cement our identity in this body. So many ways that this body can be identified. You know, I'm a male, I'm born here, I do this job, I work there, I go there, I have this friend, I have this family, etc., etc., etc. In this way, we become totally enamored with the bodily identification. So this is the symptom of the soul. And of course, then we had yesterday's verse, we were talking about experience a dream or a daydream. And we do not remember. It's interesting, there's the word for daydream. Does anybody remember the word for daydream from yesterday's verse? It's a very interesting word. Does anybody remember the word? Manoratam. Manoratam is the word for daydream. And if we think about what this word, how this word is constructed, what does it mean? Chariot of the mind. This is the word for a daydream. So what is a daydream? It's that thing which is like distracts you, takes you totally away from where you're meant to be or what you're doing. So this is the mind. It's like a crazy chariot that'll just take you here and there. Manoratam, very interesting word. Chariot of the mind. This is a word for daydream. Because I can remember in my high school days when I perhaps should have been paying more attention or whatever, you know, I would daydream. And, you know, my mind would be taken out the window to whatever was going on. Or even just the ripples on the glass. You know, sometimes there's some deflection on the glass and you just move your head this way and that way and the images in the distance would distort. You know, it's just like total phantasmagoria, nonsense. Just not to pay attention to my real purpose. You know, the maths class or whatever it was. So this is daydream. This is daydream. This is the mind taking you away from where you were meant to be, what you were meant to be doing. What is your real purpose? Of course, we have to understand who we are to know what is our real purpose. So here we have, of course, furthermore, in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, some of the distinguishing factors of the soul are mentioned, you know, in a sequence of verses in the earlier part of the second chapter, or towards the middle part. Thanks for so just can somebody so I can give my throat a rest for a couple of minutes. Some people want to contribute some ideas. Many of you have studied the Bhakti Shastri, which unfortunately I haven't. I've just had to study by my own over the years. But so from Bhakti Shastri you have learned in the second chapter many of the qualities of the soul which distinguish it from the body. Right? Any helpers? Indestructible. Yeah?
Cannot be burned.
Eternal.
Present everywhere.
It's present everywhere. Does that mean I'm all pervasive? Individual souls are present everywhere. Not that my soul is present everywhere. Is that right? I thought I was God there for a minute. Hare Krishna. Okay. Any others? There's quite a few.
Immeasurable.
I thought it was 100th times 100th at the tip of a hair. But I can take my whatever it is, instrument, and split a hair 100 times and then split it again 100 times. That's not a real measure, by the way, it's just to give an idea. So it is immeasurable, you're right. But there is that verse also that describes, just to give an idea of how, because it is actually difficult to measure, to split a hair 100 times and then split it again 100 times.
Cannot be burned, cannot be dried.
Cannot be withered by the wind. Yeah. Yeah. Cannot be dried, yeah. Any other we got it covered yet? I'm sure there's a few more. Anyway. Cannot be cut into pieces. So this was Arjuna's lament. He was thinking he was going to be cutting his friends and relatives into pieces with his sword and his bows and arrows, right? So Krishna's telling him, you can't touch him.
There is no birth or death for the sword.
No birth or death. Very good. We're just discussing it, yeah? Okay. He cannot be slain. He's not slain when the body is slain, right? So many things there in the second chapter described. Actually, then there's this, the verse at the beginning of all that. As I think Radhika Raman Prabhu mentioned this word in his class, that sat refers to both reality and eternality, the same word. Right? So that which is real. So this word is actually used in the 16th verse of the second chapter. Well, sat and asat. Nashato vidyate bhavo, nabhavo vidyate sata. So this says that of the non-existent, the asat, referring to the material body, according to this verse, has no substantial existence. Isn't it? Just like in this verse today, we have the word referring to the reality of the soul. Does anybody remember that from the verse? When we did the word for word, the reality of the soul, it's up there in the verse. See if you remember. Vastuni, in the reality of the soul. Vati appears. So this word, vastu, is something I studied at one time. So the vastu, there's two words, there's vastu and there's vastu. So the vastu is the primordial substance, the generating principle. And the vastu is that which manifests from that energy, like that. So the vastu, that is the primordial reality. So the soul, in this sense, used to define the soul, vastuni, of the soul. So the soul, that is referred to as sat. And it has no cessation. It cannot be. All those things we talked about which bring an end to the body do not apply to the soul. Whereas the body is asat. It is temporary. It is non-eternal. It has no substantive reality. And therefore it can be chopped to pieces, withered by the wind, burnt by fire, etc., etc. All those things we just described. So, excuse me. So, anyway, so the mind brings us to our different bodies in this way. Is it? In this verse, we get the statement that the self or our ego, our identity of self, thus becomes the creator of external and internal duality. Or as Maharaj said the other day, in his last Sunday, I think it was in his class, and I'm sure I've heard him say this before, some of you who are his disciples may have heard it more regularly, this statement, he says that belief becomes biology. Does he use that often? Because when he said it last week, it sounded familiar, like I'd heard it before, but I've only been to a handful of his classes. Anyway, belief becomes biology. So this idea that the concept of self that we evolve through our contact with the material energy generates the biological body, like that. So in this way, the self creates the external and internal duality. So here we are, there's the self, the sat principle, the reality, the internal reality, and then there's the external non-reality. Right? So there's this duality at play. Right? So anyway, so this body is created like that through this way. And we become the qualities here described, what the wealth, beauty, strength, intelligence, fame and detachment of different bodies. So these qualities we generally hear them discussed in reference to the possessor of those opulences as Bhagavan, right? That the living entities possess them to some degree, and to the degree they possess them, they identify their bodies and they are considered to be in various degrees of excellence or normality or inferiority is mentioned here like that. So we acquire through this process of identification and building our different bodies through this evolved consciousness, we acquire a particular body, and then from that body we observe and judge others, and we place them and we categorize them as being similar to ourselves, greater than ourselves, or lesser than ourselves. And actually the judgment of this tends to be fairly subjective, right? So whether or not somebody else sees you as being higher or lower, the tendency is to think that I am in the higher position, right? So I was remembering one TV commercial that was running a few years ago. I don't know if this is a question for PR or not, but it involves the great Australian culinary delicacy, which we won't mention what it is necessarily, but I don't think it's really a question, but it might be. I don't know what those questions. We don't have to sit that if we're born here. So it's you guys who have been through it or are about to go through it, you get to know more about Australian history than we ever learnt. Anyway, that aside. So this commercial shows these construction workers on their lunch break, and they're outside the glass wall of a very fancy restaurant, maybe on the Sydney Darling Harbour or somewhere like that. So inside the restaurant you've got these very sophisticated businessmen with their suits and ties sitting down with their silverware, eating a very well presented meal of something. And then you've got the working boys sitting out there with their Australian piece of food, if it can be called that. And they're looking at, because, they're looking inside at them saying, they've got no idea. Right? That's the caption. They've got no idea. Right? Kanapati grew up here, he knows. He's more Aussie than most of us. Right. So, they've got no idea. So they're eating just their pie and with a big dollop of tomato sauce on top. And they're looking at the guys inside, with their collars and ties saying, they've got no idea. So they're thinking, actually, they've got it, right? They're just workers, on their lunch break. So this is our perception. Of course, then we look at it and we think, neither of them have got any idea, right? Because, we've got a different taste, we've got a different experience, we've got the Lord in his Mahaprasadam, and, it's all, sattvic ingredients prepared with love and devotion and offered to the Lord, and then taken in good company and everything else. From our experience, that experience that we have You know, it means they've got no idea how to eat. You know, even I can remember, even this was a few years before I became a devotee, but somehow or other I must have, you know, inculcated this idea. I was just at home and I was talking to my sister about, because at that stage I'd been vegetarian for a number of years, and a number of my siblings were showing inclination to be vegetarian, and most of them have been for some time during their life, not necessarily maintained it. But anyway, I was describing that the qualities of the food we eat are somehow or other not only on what ingredients we use, but that essential ingredient is the mood of preparation, you know, sort of where it's prepared with love, it's grown, nurtured, you know, and taken with love. So I had somehow or other had this idea of love being an essential ingredient in the preparation and serving of food. And, you know, she thought that was pretty profound, you know, telling that to my teenage sister. So this is the quality, the perception we have, is it? So people judge others to be high, middle, or low class according to their material situation. So according to that, we see. But we also know, as mentioned here, that this soul, he has no real connection with any of these external definitions or situations, right? He exists beyond material duality. But due to misfortune or whatever, he's falsely mistaking the material situation to be his own. The other thing that is mentioned here, the significance of the words asasyana kridyata. So the word jana comes up twice here. So jana is a generic person, a generic word which means a person, right? And in the English language we have the name John, which is very similar and is basically a common, very common name. So jana and John, it's the same thing. And in other languages there's variations of that. So John, you just see a regular John or whatever, you know, it's a common name. But jana is like that, it means the same thing. It's just a common name referring to a man. So... So here, you know, and was it Gandhi had the idea that, you know, all men, whatever, you know, whatever their position, whether they're perceived to be high, middle, or low, they're actually all basically good. They're all of God, right? So therefore, he had the name Harijan to refer to, you know, basically everybody. You know, that everybody is Harijan. That is, they are a person of God. But here we have the phrase Asajjana, right? Which has been translated here to mean a bad person.
Sajjana is good person. Asajjana is bad.
Yes, sajjana is good person. Asajjana. Yes, sajjana. Yeah, that word is there, right? It's interesting. But in the composition of that word, we've got the words sat and asat again, right? That which is eternal, has reality, is substantive, is, you know, is real, and asat, which is temporary. So good and bad is also based on that, those two words in this. Yeah. So this idea that giving birth to a bad son. And sometimes, you know, so it's described here, the description here actually reminded me of, excuse me, you know, we can say a father or a mother here, you know, may be peaceful, but because the son gets into trouble, the father is forced to defend his son and consider his son's enemies to be enemies of the entire family. So this, in my mind, generated an image of the, Mafia mama. Right? So So she's got, you know, there's my little bambino. He's a good boy, you know, right? He might be a 38-year-old gun-touting, drug-dealing, you know, gangster, but he's a good boy. He's my bambino. He's a, you know, why are these police and everybody giving him such a hard time? Right? So this is the nature of the parents, even though they may have produced a bad son because of filial affection and attachment to those bodies, you know, they only see the good. Right? They only see the good. Of course, then, you know, closer to our own scriptures, I guess, there's another example that comes to mind also of a bad son. And then, you know, and whose father kind of took alignment with his troublesome attitudes and behaviours. Right? Do we know who he is? Duryodhana. Of course, it's obvious, isn't it? Duryodhana. When Duryodhana was born, you know, he's such a bad son. Such a bad son. I mean, his very birth was accompanied by, you know, shrieking jackals and crows and shrieking of birds, and, you know, the heavens rained pasta and urine, and what, you know, it was just like, you know, how inauspicious, you know, how inauspicious, you know, and he was, Dhritarashtra was advised, get rid of this son immediately. So no matter how bad your son is, or your child is, the affection is there, and you can't do that. As a parent, you can't do that. Even though he was advised, this son will wreak havoc on the family. So they're defending him. And then, of course, as time went by, and we all know the story of the Mahabharata and how it went on, then, you know, the father had to consider his son's enemies to be the enemies of the whole family, and therefore we end up with this fratricidal war, which became unavoidable. You know, so many ways they tried to avoid it, but because of the persistent, you know, uncompromising nature of Duryodhana, enemies were defined. Family enemies were defined, and the battle had to ensue. So much trouble created by this. So here we see, and then we see here, beyond that, in this purport. So therefore, you know, this bad son implicates the father and the whole family in troublesome conflicts. But the spirit soul itself has no intrinsic problems. He cannot be affected or afflicted in any ways by the material energy. Right? It's only due to the false identification with a material body that the soul becomes involved in the happiness and distress of the body. This is called matraspashas. Right? Matraspashas actually means sense perception. Is that right? Am I correct in saying that? Let me see. Matraspasha, sensory perception. So this sensory perception is, again, it is the mind which becomes the dominant force in determining our identity. Even you know, philosophers who have thought about, you know, our internal identity, they get to the mind, and then that's for, you know, and I think Prabhu mentioned also Descartes the other day, who arrived at the philosophy, I think, therefore I am. So he established, Descartes, 300 or 400 years ago, he established this idea that because I think, I am. And that thinking vehicle is the mind. So therefore, you know, identify with the mind, which is a subtle material element. So by material endeavour, this is basically the limit. By material sensory perception or material material-based inquiry which is based on my own empiric capacity to observe, you know, is limited to the realm of material energy. So it can reach to the subtle realm of the mind and practically speaking go no further. So therefore, without God consciousness, without surrender to, you know, that higher principle that there is a supreme and independent creator, then we are limited to what is perceptible within matter. And on the subtle realm, that is the level, that's the mind. So the empiric philosophers, they get to this level, and that's as far as they can go. When I was in South Melbourne the other day, I saw on a TV screen somewhere, just, you know, a newsreel. And you know how they have those little captions underneath that go by, little headlines? And it said, this one caught my eye, it said, "Atom smasher close to God principle." Has anybody read any news lately to know what that story's about? Adrian?
I was a few years ago now, but I saw a similar article in a science magazine saying that the atom smashers are looking for gravity, induced gravity.
Yeah.
And now they're the God particle. Which is an interesting way of trying to find God.
Yeah. Stokey, you were going to say something about that? Same? Oh, okay. So, yeah, but this is one this week again. I remember that a couple of years ago when they had that big accelerator in Europe or wherever it was. What's it called?
Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah. Sounds good. Which university did you go to? Anyway, I remember Burijan Prabhu discussing this one time. He says, "So anyway, so let's just say Krishna reveals himself to these guys, you know, in their atom smash, and suddenly there he appears. And then what are they going to do? They're going to smash Krishna's heart, you know, the super soul's heart. And what are they going to find? They'll find the devotees in there. Oh, what's next? They smash the devotees' hearts, and then they find Krishna. They smash Krishna's heart, and then they find the devotees. And they still get to no conclusion. But of course, Krishna doesn't subject himself to their whims like that. So anyway, the soul has no intrinsic problems. The problems only arise from sense perception, the identification of the mind with the senses and so on, and then the body like that. Excuse me. So this verse is mentioned here, right? "The mind appears to come into being and to suffer annihilation along with the objects of perception." So this idea that the sense perception is what, and the entanglement of the mind is what entangles the living entity in material consciousness. There's one and due to this entanglement with the objects of the senses and the different perceptions, the soul becomes entangled, involved in happiness and distress associated with the body. Excuse me. So that's, if we go back to 2:14 again, my throat's just about run out of steam. But in verse 2:14, we get this mantra spasasta kunteya sutosna sukha dukha gam payano nichas tam stitiksasva bharata. So if we understand that these dualities of happiness and distress, summer and winter seasons, etc., if we understand that it is only sense perception and that's all it is, then, and we are something separate from that, then we just let it pass. We tolerate. We don't let it disturb us. That is part of the process of self-realization. We understand like that, and therefore, you know, we can appreciate that the soul has no intrinsic problems within material nature. Like that. All right. I've run out of path here. I can't talk anymore. So I'll just try and read the verse again. Because the mind, which is the resting place of the senses, has created the identification with a new body, the threefold material variety of high, middle and low class appears as if present within the reality of the soul. Thus the self creates external and internal duality, just as a man might give birth to a bad son. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Stretching. You have to make up a question if you put your arms up any higher. Yes,
can you give some example that we are not the body in our spirit soul?
We are not the body. We're not. You want an example? How many people are there here? How many ants are there crawling around? How many examples do you want? No, you want something more practical. Sorry. What exactly do you mean? Sorry. We're always thinking that we're the body. Yeah.
How can we tell ourselves that we are spirit soul?
How can we tell ourselves? We have to take, just like the earlier verse I quoted, refer to those who see the truth, the tattvadarshis. So somebody who actually knows the truth, and just like when we're little, we don't know so much, and we're always asking our parents or our teachers or whatever, what is that? Why is it like that? You know, Prabhupada gave the example. He saw the cars going, because when he was a child, he used to see horse and cart, and then there were auto cars. Right? And then he said, so what's making the car go? It's not like the Flintstones where they got little feet running out the bottom. There's actually another motor in there, right? Something else. But so the tattvadarshis, they are the seers of the truth. So we have to take knowledge from them, because if we're relying on our own limited senses, as I mentioned, they only have scope within the material energy, and even then, limited according to the faculties of our individual conditioning. You know, some senses, it's like my vision is real blurry at the moment. Even with my glasses, it's fuzzy because of my flu. But even, you know, when my eyesight's good, I can only see a certain colour spectrum, or my hearing can only hear a certain range. But some other bodies have different ranges. You know, elephants can hear a much lower pitch. Dogs, for example, hear a much higher pitch, and so on. So, in order to understand, we have to take information from those who see the truth. What is the difference? So, the example I can think of that Prabhupada would often refer to is that by nature, we are pleasure-seeking. But by experience, we're acquiring pain in so many ways. Pain and suffering, right? Our experience of conditioned life is painful. When we honestly look at it, it is painful. Even the sort of roller coaster ride, and sometimes happy, sometimes at the top, and sometimes flying down, you know, is actually distressful in many ways. But by nature, we are pleasure seeking, and we hear definition that this is the nature of the soul, that it is ananda. So because intrinsically we are pleasure seeking, intrinsically we don't want to die, yet we see that the bodily condition is not like that. So just on this point, you know, we can get some appreciation that because of my inclinations and aspirations, then I am not the body, because the body experiences differently to what I inherently want to experience. Does that help? And can anybody else give an example for that? Sorry, Prabhu.
I have a couple of questions. One is, we often speak of the material mind as different from the soul, as a kind of a separate entity from the soul that pulls us here and there, and you know, needs to be controlled separately, etc. But a spiritual soul, I mean, a spiritual soul has an attribute.
Is there another type of soul?
Well,
sorry.
I suppose there might be, but anyway.
Yeah.
A spirit soul has a spiritual mind, which is an attribute, a non-different attribute as well, right? Just like the spiritual intelligence itself.
Mm-hmm.
And when it becomes covered over by the material energy, it becomes the material mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just wondering, how is that, that we speak of that material mind as being separate, as if we are observing it, doing other things, and we kind of interacting with a different entity.
Okay. So the conditioned mind versus the spiritual mind.
Well, or a conditioned mind versus spiritual.
Okay. Challenging question. The conditioned mind, which is if we just go back a few verses and which we quoted, the reason the conditioned mind is bound in material energy and bound to the reactions of fruitive work, as mentioned here, is that it's always meditating on the objects of the senses. And that's the conditioning. You know, the conditioning identifies with the body and therefore seeks to gratify the senses of the body. So that is a conditioned mind. Because I think the question goes back to the original choice that the jiva makes. At some point in his primeval existence, he makes a choice. And this is, you know, from the Tathasta Shakti platform that the jiva comes from. You know, it's imperceptible and it's hard to know how or why we made a choice this way or that way. But the choice was made. So the same qualities of the living entity are there. You know, the pure spiritual existence of the jiva also has a body, also has senses, also has a mind, has all of these things. Nothing exists in materially, you know, there's nothing in material existence that doesn't have its archetypal perfection in the spiritual realm. So we have that, but we choose the conditioning, just like we go to the shop and we choose our coat, our clothes. So we choose the conditioning. So we choose a conditioning which is independent of loving service to Krishna, or we choose a conditioning which is in pursuit of our own independent happiness. I mean, that's basically the choice we make. And therein lies the essential difference. It's an attitudinal one. Right. So as soon as we can reflect that attitude back to wanting to serve Krishna, And that's what, you know, Prabhupada and the Acharyas and, you know, the Association of Devotees is trying to lead us back to. Come on. Come on. You're coming. They work hard, you know, because we resist it. Because we have allowed ourselves to become conditioned. And I don't want to take this coat off because I'm cozy in this coat. It's keeping me warm right now. But it's the one, it's also keeping me from my real position with Krishna. So that attachment. So anything that's left of that, you know, prohibits us, you know, getting into that realm of pure love for Krishna and that pure state of mind, that pure perfect body, the Siddhadaya form, Asarup. Like that. I'm not sure if I've answered it very well, but anyway, that's the general idea as I can understand. Hare Krishna.
One more question, sir. That is, you mentioned belief becomes biology, that's from the Bhagavad Gita.
Yes.
I'm just wondering, does it mean, you know, just on the material platform, I guess, or how does it work?
Sorry.
Does it work, for example, can someone make oneself sick through their belief, and can they heal themselves through the belief in the material body? That's one thing. And also, this belief, is it something material or is it something spiritual?
The belief that makes one well or sick?
Well, the belief that death does.
Belief becomes biology is a an aphorism I believe that describes the migration of the soul under the influence of the mind. Is that, and it came, I asked the question of Maharaj. I think, you know, he made the point, he had made the point, but he also made the point as part of that answer. That, like in the 15th chapter of Gita, it describes that the mind carries the soul to its next body, you know, according to the conception, the evolved consciousness. You know, like the air carries aroma, like that.
Second body.
Sorry?
You mean the second body carries?
Yeah. Well, essentially the mind.
Yeah.
It's the subtle body. Essentially it's the mind that carries that. And like it's mentioned here, and the soul's just the passenger following like that, because it has no better conception. It's basically identifying itself with the mind, and the process of dying is forgetfulness of that previous identity coming into, and the birth is identifying with a new situation. So the belief, meaning that conception of who I think I am. You know, we might tell people that you're eternal spirit soul, and they say, well, I don't believe in that. I only believe what I can pinch and feel. You know, I believe I am this body because it's here, I can feel it. I can. So the idea of belief becoming biology is that conception of who you think you are that is carried within the subtle body to transmigrate you to the next body generates the body, which is biologically constructed. So in that sense, belief becomes biology.
So is that the only word between different births, or as we move, you know, from the youth to the middle age to the old age, etc., we also take on new bodies or anything like that?
Yeah, because taking in the body, we're also, who believes, as much as we may want it, who believes they're not getting old? It's part of the conditioning, isn't it? That you're going to get old. So you get old. It's part of the conditioning. You're going to die. So you die. You know, when you're a child, you want to grow up because you can see grown-ups can do much more things that I can't do now. And then when you're old, you want to be a child again, because you can see children can do so many things that I can't do now. So you take birth again. That's part of the conditioning. So there's a belief system inherent in that conditioning. Whether you correctly or properly understand it as transmigration of body, whether it's through, you know, childhood, youth, old age, death and childhood again, or not. But there's a belief system inherent in that conditioning, that I'm going through these stages of life, and therefore you do. And of course then there's other people, you know, who talk about, you know, maintaining health or getting over disease just through, you know, mind power or whatever, that, you know, that by healthy attitude you maintain a healthy body. Of course. Of course, if you have a healthy attitude, then you do the things necessary to maintain a healthy body, because that's that attitude permeates in your activity. It's not just like, yeah, I believe I am fit and healthy and I will never get sick, and I sit there, you know, feeding my face with cream puffs and, you know, not getting up off the chair. Of course I'm going to get sick. But I believe, no, the attitude, the belief is expressed in your behaviour also, and it manifests in your body. Just like the face is the index of the mind, right? So you see that your devotees are generally happy because their mind is fixed on the all-blissful, attractive form of the Lord. It's like, you know, Bhakta Prabhu gave the example of Puri Prabhu yesterday. Anything else? Mahatma Prabhu.
King Vena is another example. King Vena?
Yes.
Another example. Bad son. So, Brahmana had to produce King Prithu.
Yes. Very good. Yes, another bad son. Produced a good son. Okay. Jai Ho Gaurisa Srila Prabhupada, Kantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.